Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from the mushing capital of the world, Willow, Alaska, and we are simulcast right now on KVRF 89.5 FM in the Mat-Su Valley. You can listen to us anytime after our broadcast on mushingradio.com. And on the line, we have our Iditarod co-host. He is writer and director of Mush the Movie, Alex Stein, calling in from sunny California. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. This is the time of the race where if I'm not up there, I really find myself missing it and wishing I were out there right now. Things are really getting exciting now, and we have almost too much stuff to talk about.
We do, and unfortunately, we only have a 30-minute show here on Mushing Radio. But before we get into tonight, I have a question for you. I was going to ask you this last night. When you came up to film your movie and to interview all of the mushers, did you go to some of the checkpoints? And if you did, how far up the trail did you go?
I went to a couple of the checkpoints. I flew into McGrath, and I spent a couple days in McGrath and around there. And then I also went up all the way up to Nome. So if I had a lot more money and the helicopter that the documentary crew that's following Lancet has, I wanted to go all up and down the trail. But I wasn't able to do that, so I just went to a few places rather than everywhere.
Well, you know, McGrath, I haven't been to McGrath or Nome. I have one of those crazy musher superstitions saying that I will not go to Nome unless I'm on a set of runners. But McGrath appears to be a pretty good place for a lot of the media and spectators to fly into. How was the hospitality there for somebody that's not necessarily involved with the race, whether they're the formal media or the mushers or the volunteers? How do they treat you up there?
They were fantastic. The entire town really gets into the spirit of the race, and everyone I talked to there was very forthcoming, just wanted to share their experience and tell me all about, how the Iditarod was for them. And it was really just a wonderful, wonderful place. And I really would love to go back there. And in addition, there are probably 8 or 10 villages along the trail that I've met people who are from those villages who have told me, oh, well, you need to come here and you need to come here. And I do want to go to all of them.
Of course. Any story that stands out from your time there in McGrath, whether it be with a musher or just your experiences there, or maybe some of the folks that you spoke to other than mushers, anything stand out real quick? I know it's only been a couple of years, but they kind of mush together, at least during Iditarod season.
Yeah, one of my favorite things is that the Pen Air, which is one of the longtime sponsors of Iditarod, gives a prize to the first musher who comes into McGrath. And usually that will be on Tuesday night. And knowing that, I timed my trip there so that I would be there when that happened. And the entire town comes out to celebrate that. And at the checkpoint when the first musher came in, and that year it was Jeff King, there are 400 people who live in the town, and there had to be at least 600 people there.
Wow.
You know, it seemed like everyone who lived there was there, and then there were a lot of people who had flown in who were all out, and it was cold. It was 15 or 20 degrees below zero, and then it got a lot colder. But everybody was out there outside. There was a bonfire that was in a trash can, and everyone was kind of hanging around out there. And I got to speak to the mayor of McGrath, and I asked him what his favorite thing was, and he said, well, look around you. It's the middle of the night, it's 20 degrees below zero, and the entire town is here.
Very cool. Very cool. Thanks for sharing that story with us. You know, a lot of listeners have been asking, you know, tell us some, you know, some firsthand stuff. And that's what we try to do on this show. I think we've done pretty well with that. We try to cover that stuff every night. And some of the firsthand stuff we're going to talk about tonight when we talk about our featured musher. But before we do, right before airtime, you mentioned that we had another scratch. I think it's the fifth scratch of the 2013 Iditarod. Still very few mushers have scratched this far into the race. Who was that?
That was Mike Supernaut. And I know that he scratched in Iditarod. There's not a lot of detail right now. This just happened very, very recently. I know he had been having a bit of a hard time with the race and was fairly far back in the pack. So he just scratched about 20 or 30 minutes ago.
And I know Mike appeared in your movie, Mush the Movie. Any stories that you recall about him?
Yeah, he's just a fantastic guy, and he came up here originally. He was in the Air Force, I believe, and then started living in Alaska and was around dog mushing and got himself a couple of dogs, and then decided that he wanted to get a little bit more serious about it. So he started building up a kennel, and, you know, he said that he loves living in Alaska because he likes to climb mountains and be out in nature and run the Iditarod.
So he caught the mushing bug while he was in the Air Force.
Yeah. Yeah. Either while he was in or right after.
Sounds pretty typical, doesn't it?
It kind of does. That's the way it goes. You start hanging around, and then you get a dog or two, and you say to yourself, this is it. I'm only going to get one or two dogs. And then before you know it, you have 15 or 25 or 50 dogs.
That's exactly right. That's how I started way back in the 90s, and I'm still trying to capture that first Iditarod. So I know exactly what Mike was thinking when he got his first couple, as well as probably every other musher out there. So let's talk about the race. We are, what are we at, day 8 of our coverage, day 7 on the trail. So they've been on the trail for a straight solid week now. What's happening? Most of the front runners are well on to the Yukon River, making their way up towards Unalakleet, and then, of course, on the home stretch home and into Nome. What's happening today?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that happened today. Probably the first thing and that we should talk about is that the temperatures, which are still warm, are still probably 30 to 40 degrees warmer than a lot of people would like. The temperatures have dropped and are now on most of the trail are below freezing. So at least it's still warm for the dogs, but at least it's not as ridiculously warm as it has been for the past couple days.
Right.
But because it's been so warm, there reportedly the trail from Eagle Island up to Caltag on the Yukon River was very bad, and there was a lot of overflow, a lot of water on the trail. And so it was a really, really difficult slog up there. Martin Boozer, who has really been dominating the race, was having a very hard time today going up from Eagle Island to Caltag. His speeds were consistently 1 to 2 miles per hour below the speed of Ali Zirkel and Aaron Burmeister and Jake Berkowitz and the entire pack that has been chasing him. So Ali actually stopped about 8 miles short of Caltag and camped there rather than going into the checkpoint. But she started, when she left Eagle River, I believe she was 19 or 20 miles behind. And when she stopped, she was only 3 or 4 miles behind. So it is looking like, and she's on the move now, it looks like she's just getting into Caltag. Mitch Seavey is there, Martin Boozer is there, Jake Berkowitz, Yor Olsom, and Jesse Royer are all in Caltag, and Aaron Burmeister. And it would it would seem to be that Martin Boozer is probably not going to be in the lead for very much longer.
Right, and I know you had said something on Twitter or Facebook about that slowing down and whether his dogs have flamed out. I know we talked a little bit about that yesterday. And as the race progresses, it's tough to keep up with the pace that he was doing from pretty much the start in Willow all the way up to about this point now. What do you think? Or do you think his dogs are slowing down enough where they are going to have, I don't want to say problems, but at least difficulties on the trail?
Well, you know, we always hope that they don't have difficulties, but it seems like a lot of the other teams are just having faster run times, and when they're running, they seem to be going faster and maybe needing a little bit less rest. So Martin had that epic run the first day of the race, and then was seeming to be able to hold on to the ground that he gained up until today. And the trail today just seemed to take a lot out of him. He described it, or it was described in Alaska Dispatch, I think, as snowy soup coming up to Caltag. So as the temperatures drop, hopefully the trail will harden up a little bit and get better. But it looks like his dog team, you know, might have trouble keeping up with some of the faster teams that are on the trail now.
So I'm going to put you here on the spot, Alex, at least in terms of a math question, but do you have any idea how long the trail is on the Yukon River? I don't think a lot of people understand how long those guys are running on the river, pretty much just flat, straight, scenic, no trees or anything, just running on the river. Do you know how far that is?
Yeah, it's hang on, let me just see. I love when you make me do math. It is on the river, and this is going up the river as well. It's about 140-150 miles.
Right. And, you know, just from my firsthand experience doing a lot of river running here in Willow up to some of the Iditarod checkpoints, Gietna Station and Squintna and further above, the dogs really start to get burned out on that relatively soon when they're just in the middle of an expanse of nothing. So especially dogs that are used to running in the woods or running through trees and forests and things, it can really take it out of a dog team just to be on that flat, you know, no obstacles at all except for the little trail markers or possibly other snow machines or media or whatever that's traveling up and back and forth. But other than that, it is very desolate out there.
Right. And my understanding, and I haven't been there, so I don't have firsthand experience with this, is that because it's the southern route and they are essentially going up the Yukon River, that the prevailing winds are mostly against them. So those 140 or 150 miles are often into the wind.
Right, which makes it very difficult. And, you know, one other piece of mushing tech here, a lot of folks see the mushers wearing the white coats that often look like rain gear over their parkas. Those are wind coats that they're wearing. Often many mushers will wear a full suit of this wind material. And it is said that those suits that they wear, they cost about $200-$250 for a suit. Those can raise the temperature, the core temperature inside of the suit, up to 20 to 30 degrees. So that's why you'll often find a lot of these guys wearing these white suits looking like the Abominable Snowman or Stay Puft the Marshmallow Man as they travel down the trails. That's what those are for. They're windbreaking suits. It keeps them a little bit warmer out there.
Right. We also heard earlier this afternoon that there was a dog that was airlifted from Eagle Island to Caltag, and the vets were very worried about this dog. We're trying to get more information about what the status of that dog is, but at the moment, all we know is that there was a dog that was in considerable distress. We're not sure whose dog it was, but it was airlifted from Eagle Island to Caltag. And they were talking about if they can't stabilize the dog in Caltag, that they might take it to Unalakleet, which is the closest, more major place.
Speaking of dogs, Alex, several days ago we talked about Ramey Smith and losing his dog from one of the vets. The vets pulled him, he or she, out of the race because of a increased heart rate. Where is Ramey right now in the standings? I'm trying to pull up on iditrod.com. I guess I have a slow internet. Where's Ramey Smith right now?
Ramey Smith is in 26th place. It looks like he is he's out of Grayling, so he's somewhere between Grayling and Eagle Island right now.
So the top third, not doing too bad, but not the typical position for Mr. Ramey Smith, who usually puts the pedal to the metal at about this point in the race and really starts leapfrogging a bunch of mushers. He's been pretty much in that middle of the pack the whole race, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. He's the type of musher who really turns on the speed in the last third of the race, too. So if he is going to make a move, I would expect that he would be doing that sometime in the next day or so. You know, he'll probably be into Caltag probably tomorrow morning. And then from there, it's a pretty straight shot to the coast in Unalakleet. And from there on is where he really shines.
So one more math question before we move into our featured musher tonight, who is Mitch Seavey. How far are we from the finish? We're looking at Martin Boozer, Mitch Seavey, Aaron Burmeister, Jake Berkowitz, Jesse Royer, and Yor Olsom in the top six. How far are we from the finish line at Caltag and beyond?
From Caltag, we're still about 350 miles from the finish.
Go ahead, Alex.
It's a pretty considerable amount of distance that they still have to cover.
And remember, folks, that they still have that one final 8-hour break at White Mountain, which is the second to the last checkpoint as they head into Nome. It's White Mountain Safety and then Nome. Last year, when we were hosting Mushing Radio Iditarod coverage, the mushers finished, Dallas in particular, finished when we were on air at about 7 p.m. Alaska time, local time, on Tuesday evening. I know they're running a very fast race, but do you have any predictions or at least insight from what you're hearing throughout Insider or other news reports about when a possible finish could occur?
What we do know is that they are on a record-breaking pace. So the record, and I don't have the figure in front of me, but it's a little bit under 9 days, and that John Baker set 2 years ago. So it would not be surprising if they were to break that record by several hours.
And when would that put them? Sometime late Monday, early Tuesday morning then?
Yeah, probably sometime during the day on Tuesday.
Okay. So hopefully we're able to do what we did last year. Perfect radio setup for us. We were able to report that Dallas Seavey had won the race right on the show. And I know people got a huge kick out of that. We were covering and telling what they were doing on video and all that stuff here on the show last year. Hopefully we have one of those moments again this year.
Yeah, absolutely. One other thing that I just wanted to mention briefly, which I meant to, but I may have forgotten to, it's actually Mike Supernaut's birthday today. So certainly this is not the scratching from the Iditarod is not the birthday present that one would hope for.
Well, we hope that he's well. Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. And the other story that there was some concern that the food drop bags were not able to get to Eagle Island, and there was some confusion about whether they would have them there or not, and a lot of the earlier mushers, the mushers who were at the head of the pack, were taking extra food from their food drop bags at Grayling because they weren't sure that there would actually be any food drop bags at Eagle Island. They had flown them into Unalakleet, and then they flew them with a very small plane into Caltag, but the weather had been very bad for the past couple days, and they weren't able to fly small planes into Eagle Island. So what they finally did is they wound up having a snow machine relay from Caltag down to Eagle Island to get all of the food drop bags there, which I believe they got them there just a couple of hours before Martin Boozer came in, and he was the first musher into that checkpoint.
Never a dull moment in the Iditarod. It's definitely a 24-hour ordeal, no matter what occurs, good, bad, or indifferent. Something is always happening out there on the Iditarod Trail. So, Alex, we have about 9 minutes left. Let's get into our featured musher of the evening. As we said yesterday, when I was trying to build up Mr. Mitch Seavey yesterday, we were actually going to talk about Alan Moore. So today is Mitch's day on Mushing Radio. What do you have for us?
Well, Mitch Seavey is, as you said yesterday, is one of the leaders of what you could call a mushing dynasty. His father, Dan Seavey, was one of the mushers who helped put together the very first Iditarod in 1973 with Joe Reddington. He ran that race, and finished in third place. And Dan also ran the race along with Mitch Seavey and Mitch's son Dallas Seavey last year. So we had three generations of the Seaveys running last year. Mitch is someone who I was surprised to learn that he's only 53. And that's not because he looks old, but just because the entire time that I have been following the Iditarod, he was one of those people who was considered a veteran and someone who had been around the race forever, which I guess is accurate because he was born in Minnesota, but his dad moved the family up to Seward, Alaska, when he was 4 years old. And he basically has been mushing since he was about four or five. He ran his first Iditarod. He helped his father train for the early Iditarods in the 70s. He ran his first Iditarod in 1982. And he came in a very respectable middle-of-the-pack 22nd. He took some time off from running the race and ran a bunch of shorter distance and mid-distance races. He has run every single Iditarod since 1995.
Wow.
And has 10 top 10 finishes. This is his 19th race. And he 2 years ago, he had a very serious injury. He cut himself with a knife at one of the checkpoints, and he was actually withdrawn from the race by the race officials. The other thing that people might know about him is there used to be in Alaska many, many decades ago something called the All Alaska Sweepstakes, which was a massive, mammoth, long-distance race. And in 2008, to commemorate the All-Alaska Sweepstakes, they put on a modern version of it. And it was a 408-mile race that finished in Nome, and it had a $100,000 prize, and it was winner-take-all. And Mitch Seavey won that race in 2008, beating out Jeff King. And that could not have been a great year for Jeff King because that was also the year that Lance Mackey beat him in the Iditarod by basically sneaking out of a checkpoint when Jeff was asleep. Mitch Seavey won the Iditarod in 2004. That was in the middle of the time when Team Norway, the original Team Norway with Robert Sorley, was very, very dominant in the sport. And Cadel Beckin, who was running for Team Norway in 2004, was in the lead, and most people thought that he was going to win the race. And very, very late, somewhere on the coast, very close to Nome, his lead dog just very, very suddenly, with no warning and no explanation for what had happened, died on the trail. And his Cadel Beckin's race really pretty much fell apart. and Mitch Seavey, who was part of the pack chasing him, just pulled into the lead and managed to win that race. He operates a sled dog tour business called Iditaride, and you can go and mush his dogs and learn about mushing from Mitch and his sons Danny Seavey and Tyrell and Dallas, all of whom have run the Iditarod. His other son, Conway Seavey, is not yet old enough to run the Iditarod, but he was the junior Iditarod champ last year, and also has a pretty great singing voice. So usually at either the finisher's banquet or the starting banquet in Anchorage, you can find Conway Seavey singing. And the other thing about Mitch is he wrote a book a couple of years back called Lead, Follow, or Get Out of the Way, Unconventional Secrets of an Alaskan Iditarod Champion. And it's a wonderful book filled with anecdotes about what he's learned about dogs and his philosophy towards training dogs. He is very much a plain-spoken kind of guy every time I've talked to him and if you read his book. And he's not really interested in political correctness. He just says what he means and doesn't really bother to couch things in ways that are overly polite. Very, very down-to-earth guy. Also has a pretty terrific sense of humor, which might come across as a little bit dry to some people. He's interesting because he doesn't play the media game in the same way that some of the top contenders like Jeff King or Lance Mackey or even his son Dallas does, because those mushers are very good at talking to the press and giving entertaining sound bites. Mitch is a lot quieter and I think a bit more reserved. But always, when he's racing, is someone who is up there in the top 10 usually. He's someone who almost always is a threat to win the race, and it looks like he has a really, really good shot at it this year.
Right. You know, Alex, we have about 2 minutes left, and I want to get my two cents in here. Just a quick thing. I ran with Mitch Seavey and his son Conway this past February in the Tustamina 200, and at the Mushers meeting, what a family. Those guys just, you know, because that's their stomping grounds down there on the Kenai Peninsula, and they helped out and talked about the trail conditions, and, you know, a Mushers musher, if I've ever heard one, with Mr. Mitch Seavey and Conway. Man, what a guy he's going to be in the coming years. He's 17 years old right now. I look forward to him running Iditarod next year if he turns 18 in time. He raced with my daughter at the Willow Junior 100 this past February as well, and came really close to winning that. He lost by just a couple of seconds in that Willow Junior 100. Excellent musher. Excellent pedigree from all of the CV boys, and of course you can never count out any of them, whether it be a name like Dallas, a name like Conway, Mitch, Dan, whoever it is, they're all going to give you a run for your money. And one quick note on there, Danny CV, also an Iditarod finisher, has excellent commentary on Facebook. So if you're on Facebook, make sure you hook up with Dallas's or Danny's commentary on there. Alex, one more point before we go. Tomorrow I would like to talk about the competitive rule in Iditarod. I know we need to start talking about that at this time so folks know what it is. Anything else? 45 seconds before we go. Anything else in closing?
Just one quick thing. It looks like Allie Zirkel is now officially in the lead. It looks like she has gone in and out of Caltag and is on her way down to Unalakleet.
There you go. So everybody cheering for Allie. She is in first place, and then we do have Martin and Mitch and Jake and all those guys pretty close behind. So we'll talk to you guys next time. We are out of time. On behalf of my co-host calling in from California, Alex Stein, and I am Robert Forto, Mushing Review. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.